All righty, let's start with our review. Chapter 49 dealt with Jeremiah's, well, we're in the section dealing with Jeremiah's prophecies to the nations. Remember, Jeremiah wasn't limited strictly to Israel, but God said, you will prophesy to the nations. Okay, he's been prophesying to Edom here, Edom to the south of the Dead Sea on the eastern side of the Arabah there, the Jordan River Valley. Here is a modern map. Remember, we saw the prophecy against Ammon, northern Jordan today, against Moab, central Jordan today, and against Edom. That's the prophecy we're in now, southern Jordan today. And I said I don't think it's a coincidence that these three nations that will escape the Antichrist domination somehow are all in Jordan. Somehow Jordan is going to escape the Antichrist domination. Don't ask me how, but that's what we learned in previous lessons. Remember, God said to Edom that I'm going to be different than a grape harvester. A grape harvester would leave some gleanings for the poor to find, but I'm not going to leave nothing. You're going to be a desolate wasteland when I'm done with you. And so that put the judgment of Edom into the future. Future to us in the tribulation period, the time of Jacob's trouble. So Edom's total destruction lies future to us because southern Jordan today is quite populated. That's the area we're talking about. We zero in, first of all, on the most important city in southern Jordan. Biblically, the most important city is Petra or Basra, there in the Mount Seir mountain range. God focuses a lot of attention on Basra, Petra. Why? Well, we learn in Micah 2 that this will be the key place of Jewish refuge during the tribulation period. In the middle of the tribulation, the most important segment of Jewish people will have made a break and be holed up in Petra or Basra. And that's what Micah 2, 12 and 13 tells us. God says, I will surely assemble all of you, Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. So the whole nation is included here, Jacob and Israel. I will put them together like sheep in the fold in Basra. Basra literally means sheepfold, like sheep in Basra. Like a flock in the midst of the pasture, they will be noisy with men. So Basra, Petra will be jam-packed with Jewish people trying to escape the Antichrist. And that will be the initial point of the second coming. And when Yeshua returns, verse 13 picks that up, the breaker goes up before them. That's the Messiah King, breaking the Antichrist's 3.5-year siege of Basra. They will break out, pass through the gate, and go out by it. And so the Jewish community, besieged and beleaguered in Basra, will be able to leave. And you and I will be returning with Yeshua to minister to them. So their king goes on before them. So Yeshua is also described as the Messiah King here. He's the one who breaks the siege. He's our king. And finally, he is described as God himself. That's God's personal name. So we get a quick summary of the second coming in Micah 2, 12 and 13. But the reason Basra is focused in on is because it's the initial point of the second coming. Then we quickly went through the campaign of Armageddon. I showed you two slides, the 11 stages of the campaign of Armageddon. We'll quickly run through that. The Antichrist's armies will assemble at Armageddon, the Jezreel Valley. Here they come from every nation, representatives from every nation on the face of the earth. Stage two, the Antichrist joins his troops. He is here in Babylon, his political and economic capital. He leaves his capital and he goes to the Jezreel Valley where he takes personal command of his troops. Then we come to the third stage in the campaign of Armageddon, the destruction of Babylon. We'll look at this. We'll begin to look at this in chapters 50 and 51. Out of the north comes an army simply described as the Medes, and Babylon is destroyed suddenly and totally in a manner that she has never happened to her to date. Lies in the future. We come to the fourth stage, the fall of Jerusalem. Antichrist moves south because he's more concerned about taking Jerusalem than he is about his own capital city. And, of course, he's energized by Satan, and Satan knows that once the campaign of Armageddon is over, if it is successfully completed, then his career is kaput. So he is doing everything he can to destroy the Jewish people and prevent God's promises from being fulfilled. After a very vicious fight, Jerusalem falls. That brings us to the fifth stage. The tribulation holocaust begins as the Antichrist takes over the temple, seats himself in the Holy of Holies, and declares himself to be God. And that precipitates also the Jewish flight from Jerusalem to Basra. Those in Jerusalem and in Judea, all over the country, flee to Basra or Petra here in the Mount Seir mountain range. Well, the Antichrist doesn't want the Jewish people to escape, so his armies then move south and besiege Basra for 3.5 years, from the middle of the tribulation toward the end. Then we come to the seventh stage, the national regeneration of Israel. We call out for the Messiah to return. We place our faith in him. Every living Jewish man, woman, and child on the face of the earth becomes a believer. And with that cry for the Messiah to return, we have the second coming of Yeshua. And he returns initially to Basra or Petra. From this point, he now treads the wine press. We went into the wine press in detail. And here's the field of battle. As Joel 2:20 tells us, Yeshua goes into Teman, down into the wilderness of Paran, into the desolate Negev desert. And as he heads for Jerusalem, he splits the army of the Antichrist, pushing half into the eastern sea and half into the western sea, as we learn from Joel 2:20 and Habakkuk 3. As he approaches Jerusalem, the fighting ends in the Valley of Jehoshaphat, and I've made a slight modification to my picture here. In the past, I've shown the whole Kidron Valley as the Valley of Jehoshaphat. That wasn't quite correct. Actually, the Valley of Jehoshaphat would be limited to this section of the Kidron, just opposite the Temple Mount. That would be the Valley of Jehoshaphat. So Yeshua will tread the winepress up to the Valley of Jehoshaphat and enter into judgment with the nations. That brings us to the final step in the campaign of Armageddon, his victory ascent up the Mount of Olives. And I believe that the Valley of Jehoshaphat will be the valley formed by the splitting of the Mount of Olives north and south, but we'll see exactly how that happens. So that took us through the campaign of Armageddon. Then we learned that Edom will become a desolate wasteland, the haunt of demons. This is the area. This will be a burning wasteland. And there will be two burning wastelands in the kingdom, we learn. We learn that Babylon will be one. We've also learned that Edom will be the other. Okay, and that brings us then to page 516, middle of the page. Okay, everybody with me then? I know that was a quick review, but I always like to go over that campaign of Armageddon because there's so much material there. Okay, everybody got it memorized? Stages 1 through 11? What's stage 3? Destruction of Babylon. Okay. All right, I'll have a test on it next week, a quiz. It'll be very simple. Just outline from memory the campaign of Armageddon with a short paragraph explaining why. No more than 2 pages. Have it. We'll take 5 minutes at the beginning of the class. Okay. Point F, middle of page 516. Still dealing with the destruction of Edom. And the country of Edom, we turn in at point F to the suddenness of the destruction. And that is brought out in the first half of verse 19. We begin to examine that in the first half of chapter 49, verse 19. Okay, everybody there? All right, verse 19. Behold, one will come up like a lion from the thickets of the Jordan, against a perennially watered pasture. For in an instant I shall make him run away from it, and whoever is chosen I shall appoint over it. Okay, remember this, the context here is the destruction of Edom. Now when he talks about the thickets of the Jordan, he's talking about the banks of the Jordan, and you can see thickets there even today. And in Jeremiah's day, lions used to love to make their lairs in those thickets. So it's pretty dangerous to go down by the Jordan if you weren't careful, because a lion could leap out on you. So that's the idea. There will be a sudden attack upon Edom very quickly. And then point two, toward the bottom of the page, I will make them run away from it, run away from Edom. This is the scattering of the armies of the Antichrist at the second coming. when Yeshua returns to Basra, the important city in Edom, the armies of the Antichrist are not going to hang around. They are going to be either destroyed or run. And then it says that he will appoint over this territory the ones he have chosen to own it, basically is the idea. And this is brought out in Obadiah chapter 17 through 22. Your notes say 17 and 21, but you could read the whole section, 17 through 22. Obadiah deals with the destruction of Edom. Very short little book, one chapter. Starting in verse 17, God says, "But on Mount Zion there will be those who escape." So in other words, the Jewish people will have a remnant that survive, and it will be holy. And the house of Jacob will possess their possessions. Then the house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame. But the house of Esau, that's Edom, that's a synonym for Edom, the house of Esau will be as stubble. And they will set them on fire and consume them. So somehow the Jewish soldiers will be part of the destruction of Edom, so that there will be no survivor in the house of Edom. For the Lord has spoken. Then those in the Negev will possess the mountain of Esau, and those of the Shvelah, the Philistine plain. So the Jewish people will occupy what's known as the Gaza Strip today, and we will also possess the mountain of Esau, something we don't do today. Also possess the territory of Ephraim, that's the West Bank today, and the territory of Samaria, that's also part of the West Bank today. And Benjamin will possess Gilead, again something we do not possess today. And the exiles of this host of the sons of Israel, who are among the Canaanites as far as Zarephath, and the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Sepharad, that's Spain, by the way. There were no Jews in Spain during Jeremiah's day. This is a prophecy that there will be Jews in Spain. That's where the term Sephardic Jewry comes from, Sepharad. So this is a prophecy that there'll be Jews living in Spain in the future. Jeremiah didn't know that. Let's see. Those who are in Sepharad will possess the cities of the Negev. The deliverers will ascend to Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau, and the kingdom, that's a reference to the Messianic kingdom, will be the Lord's. So that's a parallel verse, a little more detail about what's happening in Jeremiah 49. So the picture in verse 19 is this lion in hiding, leaping suddenly on the prey. That's a picture of Yeshua returning suddenly at the very end of the tribulation period. Suddenly the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations of the earth are going to mourn and be in terror. He will come suddenly, just like a lion leaping out of hiding. And he'll be coming in judgment, like a lion tearing its prey. But when it's all done, Edom will be a burning wasteland, but it will belong to the Jewish people. There'll be nobody living there. The demons will be confined there, but it'll be part of Jewish territory. And everyone who sees it will be astonished, horrified at what has happened to Edom. Okay, let's move on to page 517. Now, who's going to do all this? A lot of junk in that, a lot of stuff, I shouldn't say junk, a lot of stuff in the first part of verse 19, isn't it? Well, who's going to do all this stuff? The Lord. Verse 19b, second half of the verse. "For who is like me?" God is speaking here. "Who is like me? And who will summon me into court? And who then is the shepherd who can stand against me?" Now, all of these phrases 1, 2, and 3 in your outline, emphasize God's sovereignty. He is going to bring all of this to pass. No one can stop him. No one can call him to account and say, "Hold up, buddy. He is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords." No leader can oppose him. And so Edom will be destroyed. So as we move on to point 3, we learn why. What is God's purpose for the destruction of Edom? We begin with a call that goes out to the entire world in verse 20. "Therefore," very important word, Therefore, because God is sovereign, you know, whenever you see the word therefore, find out what it's there for. Okay? It refers back. Therefore, because God is sovereign, hear the plan of the Lord, which He has planned against Edom, and His purposes, which He has purposed against the inhabitants of Teman. Surely they will drag them off, even the little ones of the flock. Surely He will make their pasture desolate because of them. And so here a call is issued to the world to pay attention. The world is called to understand God's decree, understand God's purpose. Point two. You know, God tells us these kinds of things because He wants us to integrate it into our worldview. We can count on this. So this better be part of our worldview. This is what's going to happen. It'll not only motivate us to holy living, it'll motivate us to evangelism as well. Because we'll say things like, ooh, those people are in trouble. You know, we need to be praying for Mahmoud. How do you say his name? If I don't see it in front of Ahmadinejad. We need to be praying for that man. You know, he's going into a godless eternity. You need to be praying for him. And anyway, God tells us this, so we'll be motivated to see things from His worldview. Remember, God does not delight in judgment. Why will ye die, He says, to the house of Israel? He doesn't delight in judgment, but He does do it because it's right. Okay, so He is going to judge Edom. And He's decreed it, so you can bet your retirement on it. Edom will be destroyed. Now, the result in verse 21 of His decree. The result, verse 21, point B toward the bottom of the page. Verse 21, the earth has quaked at the noise of their downfall. There's an outcry. The noise of it has been heard at the Red Sea. So the earth trembling at the noise of Edom's fall is a reference to this destruction happening at the second coming. This will be an earth-shaking event, literally, as Messiah returns to conquer the armies of the earth. Now, point two is an important little statement, that the noise of this judgment, the noise of the second coming, is going to be heard in the Red Sea. And that is consistent with my presentation to you of the wine press, where I say Yeshua will come out of Basra to Teman, then down into the wilderness of Paran. What's right down here? There it is. See, we have a Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba. That's the, or I should say, the Gulf of Eilat. That's the tongue of the Red Sea coming up here, the eastern tongue coming up. We have a western sea, we have an eastern sea, we have a Red Sea. So I think we've been able to, we have a wilderness of Paran, we have Teman. I think we can establish the field of battle for the campaign of Armageddon. So this is consistent, totally consistent with that picture. So Yeshua will be treading the winepress down near the Red Sea. And believe me, it won't be pleasant. But the center of the destruction, again, the focus of all this, is Basra in verse 22. This most important city comes into sharp focus one more time. Behold, He will mount up and swoop like an eagle and spread out His wings against Basra. And the hearts of the mighty men of Edom in that day will be like the heart of a woman in labor. So see the picture of the second coming again? Yeshua is going to descend out of heaven with the Shekinah glory light. And He's going to descend down on Basra or Petra like an eagle coming out of a tree down on a little rat or a bunny in the field, you know. What a picture. And what will happen to the armies of the Antichrist? You ladies that have had childbirth, you know what they're going to go through. Panic, fear, panic, pain, agony. They're going to cry out in terror. If you gave birth without any, without a spinal block or something, you know exactly what these guys are going to be experiencing. And not only that, the end times, the tribulation period, is described as like a woman in labor. You know, as the end times move along, the birth pangs get more and more severe and closer together. More and more severe, closer together. Oh, they're 5 minutes apart. Get to the hospital, you know. They're 1 minute apart, you know. I know they're 1 minute apart. And I'm just watching, you know. Nothing I can do. But, you know, after all that agony, what happens, ladies? Something beautiful is born, isn't it? And you hold that little girl or little boy in your arms and you forget totally about all the tribulation that went on just a few minutes before, right? Well, that's another reason why the tribulation and all this is compared to a woman in labor. The earth is going to go through birth pangs and birth pangs and birth pangs, and something beautiful is going to be born, the Messianic kingdom. The Messianic kingdom is going to come out of this. And we'll forget all about all that agony that went on before. So it's a great picture, a great picture. Anyway, these guys are going to be on the receiving end of the birth pangs, but we will be on the receiving end of the beauty. So we can rest in and be at peace with that. Okay, page 518. Just at the top of the page, point D, the results of Yeshua's returning like an eagle swooping down on its prey. No descendants left, no restoration. In contrast to Israel, Israel will have a remnant left. Israel will be restored. So the fate of Edom is very different than the fate of Israel. No descendants for Edom, a remnant for Israel. No restoration for Edom, a restoration for Israel. And that brings the prophecy of regarding Edom to a close. So we're at point G on page 518. Now our attention turns to Damascus or Syria. Now I want to put the map up here again because I want to try to eliminate any confusion. There are two countries that have very similar names. One is Assyria, northern Iraq today, Assyria. And the other nation that sounds very much like it is Syria. And as you read your Tanakh, as you read your historical books, it's easy to get confused between these two. Syria is also called Aram in your historical books. But it's one way to remember it, a suggestion from one of the students in the morning class. Assyria is to the north, and its capital starts with an N, Nineveh. Assyria, north, Nineveh, right? Okay. Syria is to the south, and its capital is Damascus. Two different countries. Okay? Does that clear up any confusion? Okay. Assyria is the big, mighty power that destroys the northern kingdom. Syria is the minor power that usually has an alliance with the northern kingdom. That's usually the case. Yes, question. What about Nineveh? It's close to Mosul, yes. Mosul. It's across the river from it. Yeah, the ruins of Nineveh are easily visited today. Yeah. Okay, does that make it clear? Okay. Now, let's see. Here then is Jerusalem, just even pretty much with the top of the Dead Sea. Here's Jerusalem, and here is Damascus. This is the city that's in focus here. Same city that we hear about in the news today. Very same city, Damascus. Here is the Mount Hermon mountain range. Damascus sits just to the east of the Mount Hermon mountain range. So this is the city we're talking about. And the topic is very clearly stated for us, a change in revelation in verse 23. First part of verse 23, very straightforward and simple. I need to change, turn my page here. Concerning Damascus. There we go. New revelation. There, Damascus is also the object of prophecy in point A in your outline, Isaiah 17. And make that point B, not parentheses 1. Point B, Amos 1, 3 through 5. Little misprint there. A and B. Now, with our time frame, in chapter 49, we finished up chapter 49 in the tribulation period. Now, when we get to Damascus and Syria, we're going back to Jeremiah's present time. The near future, verses 23 through 32, will be in Jeremiah's present time and the events right around his ministry. All righty. Point two on your outline, second part of verse 23. The effect on the Syrian cities. Hey, everybody there? Verse 23, second part of the verse. Hamat and Arpad are put to shame, for they have heard bad news. They are disheartened. There is anxiety by the sea. It cannot be calmed. Well, wait a second now. This prophecy said it was concerning Damascus. Why in the world are these two cities mentioned? Hamat and Arpad are two significant cities located in Syria. Why are they mentioned? Well, they're mentioned, point C, because they are ashamed and discouraged. That's what the word confounded there means. They are ashamed and discouraged because, point C, they've heard bad news. They turned on CNN and they didn't like what they saw. Evil tidings. And this bad news creates, point D, D1, they have melted away. It creates fear and anxiety. Fear, anxiety, and point two, sorrow. Sorrow. Now, wait a second, Bob. It says sorrow on the sea. You know, Syria is inland. There's no sea near Syria. What in the world is he talking about here? Well, this is probably not a literal usage of the idea of the sea, because these cities are inland. They're not near any ocean or any inland sea. Probably a metaphorical usage like Isaiah 57:20. Isaiah 57:20 says, "But the wicked are how? The wicked are like the tossing sea, for it cannot be quiet, and its waters toss up refuse and mud." See the picture there, using the sea to speak of the vast mass of unsaved humanity. The vast mass of humanity that doesn't follow God, like a restless sea full of mire and muck. Never quiet, never at peace. So that's probably the idea here. There's sorrow in these cities, in these pagan cities. They're not at rest. They're full of anxiety. They're like the tossing sea. It cannot be quiet. See point three there? It cannot be quiet. Too much turmoil. Now, why are they in so much turmoil? Well, now our attention turns to Damascus in verse 24. Verse 24. Damascus has become helpless. She has turned away to flee, and panic has gripped her. Distress and pangs have taken hold of her like a woman in childbirth. So this panic and pain and fear and anxiety that the cities of Hamath and Arpad are feeling also overwhelms Damascus. She is like a woman in travail, although this time it's not positive. It's negative. As we go on to further verses, as we continue on, the implication would be this is Nebuchadnezzar conquering Damascus. Verse 25, another reason why she's full of fear and anxiety is because her glory is departed. Verse 25. Now in verse 25, this is probably the king of Damascus lamenting. It could be any inhabitant of Damascus, but more than likely, I would say it's the king of Damascus. So here's verse 25. How the city of praise has been deserted, the town of my joy. Now, if your translation has a capital M on my, they're trying to link this to God. The translators are putting that capital M there. You know, whenever God is mentioned, they always put a capital. That's the tradition. I think it's a bad interpretive decision here. I don't think this is referring to God. I think it's referring to the king of Babylon. So I don't like the fact that they put a capital M there. It can lead you, I think, down the wrong path. But that's tradition these days. Just be aware of it. Also be aware of your italics. Remember, the italics is added words, so the translator is trying to smooth out the thought there. Sometimes it does not smooth out the thought. Okay, so the king of Damascus, I believe, is lamenting. His city is being destroyed. We turn to page 519, and we see that the city is being destroyed militarily. So this would imply that Nebuchadnezzar is doing his thing to Damascus. Verse 26, top of the page, the death of her military. Therefore, because the king of Damascus is lamenting, why is he lamenting? Therefore, her young men will fall in her streets, and all the men of war will be silenced in that day, declares the Lord of hosts. So here we have the men of war, the military, meeting with defeat and the silence of death. Defeat and the silence of death. And who is bringing this about? Well, ultimately it is God. In verse 27, I shall set fire to the wall of Damascus. It will devour the fortified towers of Ben-Hadad. And so God is bringing judgment upon Damascus. And this would be more than likely through Nebuchadnezzar. Notice on point B, he says, I will devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad. Ben-Hadad is a dynastic name for the Syrian kings. They were all called Ben-Hadad, dynastic name. And that's also the name of the storm god of Syria, point one. The storm god of Syria, and that's the same as the Canaanite Baal. Basically the same idolatry there. So God is mocking Syria on the military plane, on the political plane, and on the religious plane, and bringing judgment upon her, using Nebuchadnezzar as his instrument, just as he will use Nebuchadnezzar to bring judgment upon Judah with the destruction of the temple. You know, the heart of the king is in the hands of the Lord, the Proverbs say, and like a river course, he turns it whichever way he wants. You look at the Jordan River winding its way down the Jordan Valley. That's what God does to the hearts of kings. This way, that way, however he wants to turn them. And you know, the amazing thing is, they all make responsible decisions to do that. This is the mystery of God's omniscience and omnipotence and man's free will. Those kings make deliberate decisions to go to the right or to the left, to do exactly what God wants. It's a thought that's a little bit beyond us, but it's true. Both are taught in Scripture. All righty, now let's move on to point H. In the middle of the page, our attention now focuses on another section of the Middle East, on Kedar and Hazor. And as far as time frame goes, we are going to remain in the Jeremiah's approximate present time, near future or his present time, right around in there. But the topic changes in verse 28. Concerning Kedar and the kingdoms of Hazor, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, defeated. And you see on point H, these are Arab tribes. These are Arabian tribes living in the Arabian Peninsula. Here is a modern map of the Arabian Peninsula. And you can see some of the modern nations. Oman, this is the light area here, is Saudi Arabia. Here we have Yemen and the United Arab Emirates, etc., Qatar, etc. But the tribes of Kedar and Hazor wandered in this northern part of the Arabian Peninsula, the very northern part. Now, Kedar, point A, one of those tribes, is described there in your outline. There's cross references to Kedar, but you see point one, Kedar was a son of Ishmael, and Ishmael was a son of Abraham, one of Abraham's descendants. So we have a link here back to the Jewish people. There is a half-brother relationship between the Arab peoples and the Jewish people. The Arab peoples are not the people of promise, because the Abrahamic covenant was passed down Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then the 12 tribes. Ishmael was not included. Esau was not included. But Ishmael was blessed, wasn't he? Ishmael was blessed, and this was part of the blessing. Point B, kingdoms of Hazor, again, tribal chieftains, northern Arabian nomads, northern Arabian Bedouins. All right, what's going to happen to this group of people? Page 520, point D, the occasion is mentioned. This is what's going to happen to them when Nebuchadnezzar defeats them. Now, here is a map of the Middle East again. And when the Babylonian Empire was at its height, it encompassed this approximate area here. And the territory we're talking about is this central Arabian area. This is the habitat of Hazor in Kedar. I could only find one date regarding when commentators thought Nebuchadnezzar conquered this area, and that's the date that Dr. Fruchtenbaum has on your notes, 599 BC. So they were destroyed at approximately that date. Okay, point two on your outline. We come to point 2A, and there is a call to destroy, a call to Nebuchadnezzar. Middle of verse 28. Thus says the Lord, now this is to Nebuchadnezzar, arise, go up to Kedar and devastate the men of the east. So there's the commission to Nebuchadnezzar. Judgment on these tribes. And notice they're called the children of the east or the men of the east. He is not talking about China here. He's talking about those east of Israel. East of Israel. What will be the results when Nebuchadnezzar fulfills this commission? Verse 29, point B at the bottom of the page there. Verse 29. Here's what Nebuchadnezzar will do. They will take away their tents and their flocks. They will carry off for themselves their tent curtains, all their goods and their camels. And they will call out to one another, terror on every side. So the results, basically point one and two, the Babylonians are going to plunder these Arab tribes. They're going to despoil them. They're going to take away their valuables as booty. And there'll be a cry coming from the tribes on page 521, terror on every side. And you see point B there, the Hebrew, and the Hebrew reads Magor Misaviv. Remember that? Anyone remember Magor Misaviv? Way back in chapter 20, he was the guy that put Jeremiah in stocks, Pashur. And Jeremiah said to him, your name is no longer Pashur, but Magor Misaviv. When Babylon comes down, you're going to be judged, guy, for attacking God's prophet, basically. So it shows up here, too. All right, that's what's going to happen to Kedar. Nebuchadnezzar would... Excuse me?
So, you keep saying Islam. So, isn't this approximate time?
Yeah.
So
but he's...
this has happened?
Well, he's predicting that this will happen to Kedar and Hazor. That's what makes him a prophet. If he's talking about something that has happened, he wouldn't be a prophet, you know.
So,
he's warning.
Has already happened.
Well, it's passed to... Yeah, it's passed to us. But it was, but that's why in the time frame it's close to Jeremiah's present day. It's a short-term prophecy that verified Jeremiah as a prophet. Okay, is that clear? Did I confuse anybody? Okay. All right, let's move on to the destruction of Hazor. We've talked about Kedar now. Verse 30, God's mercy through the prophet is now extended to Hazor with a warning. God usually warns those who he judges, like Nineveh, right? Because he doesn't enjoy judgment. So the mercy is in verse 30. Run away. Dwell in the depths. Run away. Flee. Dwell in the depths, O inhabitants of Hazor, declares the Lord. For Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has formed a plan against you and devised a scheme against you. So there's the warning. Now, this warning to flee, to dwell in the depths, is a warning to dwell in the depths of the desert. Get as deep in the desert as you can. Head south. Head into the Arabian Desert proper. Get as far away as you possibly can. Nebuchadnezzar's on his way. So it's a kindness. And he's planning to pillage you. He's planning to destroy you. Unfortunately, they didn't heed the warning. Why didn't they heed the warning? That comes out in verse 31. A sense of false security. Verse 31. Now God is talking to Nebuchadnezzar here. God's words to Nebuchadnezzar. Arise. Go up against the nation which is at ease, which lives securely, declares the Lord. It has no gates or bars. They dwell alone. All right, the idea here, point one, arise and go up against the nation that's at ease. At ease. This basically, they dwell without care. They have neither bars nor gates. You see all that? These Arabian tribes, they dwell alone. They're isolated. These Arabian tribes living here in the middle of the Arabian Peninsula thought that nobody would come after them. I mean, who's going to come out into this inhospitable, desolate setting to come after us? We're the only ones that know how to live out here. You know, not to worry about Nebuchadnezzar. You know, let the world, let the hurricanes attack the rest of the world. We're safe here. You know? So, God tells them, God tells Nebuchadnezzar, they are lolling around in false security. They're not ready for you. You are going to go up and destroy them. False security. They weren't interested in listening to Jeremiah's warning. And boy, we can get that way too, can't we? Not only personally, nothing's going to happen to me, and then the housing bubble bursts, boom, you know, and all of a sudden everything you've worked for can be gone. Or we can get confidence in our country. You know, we got our military, and we got our atomic bombs, and we've got our missiles. We're okay. Never fall into the trap of false security, either personally or in any other way. But these guys did, and so page 522, the destruction is described in two facets. In two facets, verse 32. Their camels will become plunder, and the multitude of their cattle for booty, and I shall scatter all to all the winds those who cut the corners of their hair, and I shall bring their disaster from every side, declares the Lord. So the two facets, first of all, their possessions, point one there. Much to their surprise, Nebuchadnezzar will ravage and plunder them. So their possessions will be destroyed. And secondly, the second facet is the people, point two. They will be scattered to the four winds. Now, it's stated here, it's the people that have the corners of their hair cut off. Apparently, the tribes of Hazor had a unique hairstyle that identified them. And this is not something unknown in the Middle East. In fact, it's quite well known today. For example, look at these Hasids. You can always tell a Hasid by their piyot, right? Their hairstyle. The corner of their heads are never cut. Just the opposite of the tribes of Kedar. We don't know exactly what the tribes of Kedar did, but they were just as identifiable as Hasids for their hairstyle. All right, summary conclusion. Point four at the bottom of the page. Kedar and Hazor will be... verse 33. I'm missing a verse there. There's going to be this massive destruction. The results are described in verse 33. Hazor will become a haunt of jackals, a desolation forever. No one will live there, nor will a son of man reside there. Now, is this true today? Not true today, no. Plenty of people live in the Arabian Peninsula today. So that forces us to push off this particular statement into the kingdom. We're in Jeremiah's present time here. Now we have to jump off into the kingdom. And we learn that there's nobody's going to be living there during the kingdom period. It's going to be a desolation forever. That's a reference to the Messianic kingdom. So, summary conclusion, point four. Kedar and Hazor, northern Arabia, will have no inhabitants. There will be no restoration. They will be desolate throughout the kingdom. So now we learn that there will be three wastelands in the kingdom. First of all, Babylon will be a burning wasteland and a place where demons are confined. No one will live there, only demons. Secondly, Edom will also be a burning wasteland. Again, a place where demons are confined and nobody lives there. There'll be no demonization during the Messianic Kingdom, you guys. Satan will be in the abyss. His demons will be confined to Babylon and Edom, to that territory there. No demonization. Okay, so that's why conditions will be so much better on planet Earth. There'll be many people inhabiting planet Earth with sin natures, but it won't be stirred up by Satan and his compadres. Okay, now we learn there'll be a third wasteland, a desolate wasteland, Saudi Arabia. A desolate wasteland, not a burning wasteland, but uninhabited. So there'll be a swath of wasteland right across this area here, right across that area. So while the rest of the world is in blooming like the Garden of Eden, this area down here will be in a great contrast. It'll be a wasteland, very different. All righty. That brings me right to the break. 8 o'clock and 13 seconds. I'm 13 seconds over. So go ahead and take your break, and we'll pick it up on page 523. Page 523. Seatbelts fastened. Shoulder harnesses on. Okay, here we go. All right, we're picking it up then on page 523 in your notes. And we're done with Arabia. And our attention now focuses on Elam. Elam in chapter 49, verse 34. So again, the change in subject is very carefully noted for us. Verse 34. That which came as the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet concerning Elam at the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah. So where is Elam today? Here is the Middle East. Elam is often the eastern side of the Middle East, or the Fertile Crescent there, in southwest Iran today, as your notes say, point A. And the capital of Elam was Susa, or Shushan there, point B. Also mentioned in Nehemiah and Esther, Book of Esther. Now the date is very clearly given to us, the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, that'd be 597 B.C., So as far as our time frame goes, we were in the kingdom in verse 33. Now we jump back to the near future, a prediction. We're starting out in Jeremiah's present time, right around his time frame. Now, point two, Nebuchadnezzar clashed with Elam in 595, 594 BC. That's true, but he did not fulfill this prophecy, as you'll see in just a moment. The extent of this prophecy goes far beyond what Nebuchadnezzar could do, so we will move out of Nebuchadnezzar's time frame in just a moment. All right, point two, what's going to happen? Elam will be destroyed. And the declaration of destruction is point A in your notes, verse 35. Verse 35. Thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, I am going to break the bow of Elam, the finest of their might. And, of course, that reference to the bow of Elam is a reference to Elam's military might. That is going to be destroyed. So not only will the military be defeated, but there'll be a dispersion of Elam in verse 36. I shall bring upon Elam the four winds from the four winds of heaven and shall scatter them to all these winds. And there will be no nation to which the outcasts of Elam will not go. So now we're told that Elam is going to be dispersed all over the world. The idea here is a worldwide dispersion of the Elamites. Now, that has not occurred as yet, as far as we can tell. In fact, in the first century, there were Elamites who traveled to Jerusalem, mentioned in Acts 9:2. So this was not fulfilled during Nebuchadnezzar's day. And that means the fulfillment lies off in the future. There were Elamites, even in the first century. Acts 9:2. So that puts off the fulfillment, pushes it off into the tribulation period, verses 35 through 38. We'll see their fulfillment in the time of Jacob's trouble. Page 524. The destruction of Elam is detailed in greater length. Verse 37. So I shall shatter Elam before their enemies and before those who seek their lives, and I shall bring calamity upon them, even my fierce anger, declares the Lord. And I shall send out the sword after them until I have consumed them. And so there'll be destruction of Elam, and that destruction will be accompanied by death. The sword coming after them is warfare. Warfare will consume them. So they will be decimated by warfare and then subjugated in verse 38. Then I shall set my throne in Elam and destroy out of it king and princes, declares the Lord. So this setting up of God's throne in Elam is a symbol of subjugation, point A. And the kings and princes, the political leaders, are destroyed. Now the rabbis interpret this as being fulfilled. They interpret verse 38 as being fulfilled during the time of Esther and the events of Purim, as these two paragraphs we'll read show. And I will place my throne. A tremendous act of salvation for Israel will take place in their land, which will increase knowledge of the name of God. This occurred during the time of the Purim story, which transpired in Shushan, the capital of Elam. So just because Shushan is mentioned in Purim doesn't mean it's fulfilled there. There was no worldwide dispersion of the Elamites at that time. Secondly, and obliterate from it kings and nobles, a reference to the death of Queen Vashti and other nobles who were put to death at that time. Well, maybe Queen Vashti died. It doesn't say in the book of Esther. The only guy that we know who died was Haman, right? Hardly was a worldwide dispersion of Elam at that time. So the book of Esther does not fit the requirements stated in Jeremiah 49, 37, and 38. And so that dispersion lies off in the future, and it lies in the tribulation period. Page 525. At the end of the tribulation period, we'll see that God will pour out His mercy on Elam in verse 39. But, question, yes. Well, here he says there's not going to be a country in the world that doesn't find an Elamite in it. So they're going to be scattered all over the world here.
But in 36 it says they will be exiled to countries around the world.
Yeah.
Are they going to be killed after, or destroyed after they've been exiled?
No, the destruction of the land will include that exile. The land will not have its proper inhabitants living in it. So that's the factor of the destruction, one of the facets of the destruction, that its people will be gone. Okay. Alrighty, verse 39. But it will come about in the last days that I will restore the fortunes of Elam, declares the Lord. So now we're in the latter days and Elam is going to be restored. So that pushes off verse 39 into the kingdom period. There'll be a destruction during the tribulation, probably at the hands of the Antichrist. But then, in verse 39, the kingdom will be restored. And notice point B, 1, 2, and 3, as with Egypt, as with Moab, as with Ammon. This has happened before. Point 4, there will be a saved nation called Elam in the Messianic Kingdom. Question.
Who is the ancestor of Elam? Like you said, Esau was the ancestor of Edom.
Yeah, where did Elam come from? I'd have to go look up their origin.
They're not the same as Arabs, right?
No, they're Persians, Elamites. Yeah, they're not Arabs, no. Okay. All righty. So there will be a saved nation called Elam in the Messianic Kingdom. Now, point J in the middle of the page. We come to Babylon. We come to the final nation that Jeremiah prophesies against. We come to the most extensive prophecy. Chapter 50 and 51 are two very, very long chapters dealing with Babylon, exclusively with Babylon. So we have a little bit of an introduction here in verse 1, chapter 50, verse 1. The word which the Lord spoke concerning Babylon, the land of the Chaldeans, through Jeremiah the prophet. Let's see, do I have a time frame? Yeah, we're in chapter 50 here. Okay. Just some introductory input for you regarding this prophecy. The word that Jehovah spoke concerning the land of the Chaldeans. The Babylonians were descendants of a semi-nomadic tribe known as the Chaldu. And so I think it's very obvious from Chaldu we get the term Chaldeans or Chaldea, the area in which they lived. Of course, the means was Jeremiah. Point C, the perspective of this prophecy is very different from what we've seen before. Here, Babylon is seen as tottering and weak, no longer mighty and powerful as under Nebuchadnezzar, but now weak. And the tone is very vindictive against Babylon. Okay, page 526. Some main predictions are repeated over and over and over again. Point one, four times we'll see that an attack is going to come upon Babylon from the north. Repeated four times. 11 times we're going to see that there's an assault on Babylon. 9 times it's going to be stated that Babylon will be destroyed. And that destruction will be unlike anything she has previously experienced. So the emphasis here is very, very clear. Now there are other prophecies regarding Babylon, and as you look at that list of prophecies, an important skill to develop is to distinguish between Babylon of the past and Babylon of the future. Now let me summarize Babylon of the future. Babylon of the future, in fact, here's your verses. Babylon of the past is found in verses 21, Isaiah 21, 1 through 10, and 46, 1 through 47, 15. So you see your verses down there. So just write past by number 2 and number 3. Those prophecies of Babylon deal with Babylon of the past. Now what about Babylon of the past? Now, Babylon of the past was conquered by the Persians intact. This is recorded in the book of Daniel. The city was not destroyed. Daniel lived there and prospered there for many years thereafter. Taken basically without a fight. So it was conquered by the Persians intact. In 331, Alexander the Great was in charge of this area, and he wanted to renovate the city, but he didn't get a chance to because he died too soon. So the city was very much intact then. In fact, there was a large Jewish population in the city during the first century. And there was a large Jewish population in the city for a number of centuries into our era. Babylon faded into a ghost town. That's what happened to Babylon of the past. It faded into a ghost town when it lost its economic importance. The trade routes changed. Other cities became more important. Everybody moved out, just like a western ghost town here we have in the United States. It faded out into obscurity. It was never destroyed in the manner in which we will see in the next two chapters. And so, currently, the reconstruction of Babylon has begun. Now, all of you seem to be writing like crazy there. So I'm going to give you another 2 seconds. Everybody getting it down there? This is a quick history, a brief history of ancient Babylon. That's right. I want you to develop each one of those points. 1 page on each one of those points. Okay, everybody got that okay? This is the history of ancient Babylon. And of course, a lot of commentators object to this. They say, oh, no, Babylon's been destroyed. That's been fulfilled. It's out of the way, even though the history of Babylon doesn't fit the pattern in the next 2 chapters. Now, currently the reconstruction has begun, and you've seen these pictures before, taken by a U.S. Marine, of Babylon being rebuilt. Here's the interior of the city. Here's an overview. She is rising like a sphinx from the ashes. And someday, Babylon of the future will be the Antichrist's world kingdom. Babylon of the future. Babylon of the future is listed in Isaiah 13. That's number 1 on your outline. Make that right. Future by Isaiah 13, 1 through 14, 23. Also Revelation 18, 1 through 24, number 5 on your outline. That's Babylon of the future. Also Jeremiah 50 and 51. Of course, that's what you're looking at in your notes. And Zechariah 5, 5 through 11. That also speaks of Babylon of the future. What's the history of Babylon of the future? Well, she's going to be rebuilt on the same site as the ancient city. You saw the picture right here. On the Euphrates River. I don't know if that's the Euphrates out there or not, but I would assume so. Same location on the Euphrates River in Iraq, modern Iraq. It's going to become the Antichrist's political and economic worldwide capital. Question?
Didn't Saddam Hussein start the project before he died?
Yep. Saddam Hussein saw himself as a reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar, and he began this. It's on hold right now, but when things calm down over there, you can bet your bottom dollar the reconstruction will continue. All right, now, the most important aspect to note about Babylon in the future is that it's going to suffer a sudden and massive destruction, never to rise again. That's the key. That's the key. Never to rise again. That's what we're going to see here in the upcoming pages. All right, everybody ready? We're now on page 527. Page 527, point 2 at the top of the page is a very important heading. I want you to highlight it somehow in your notes. It says, Babylon's fall and Israel's deliverance. We are going to see these two topics, the Lord go back and forth between these two topics over and over again. Babylon's fall, Israel's deliverance. Babylon's fall, Israel's deliverance. Why does he jump back and forth between these two topics? Because the deliverance of Israel comes at the same time the final fall of Babylon. They happen at the same time. The end of the tribulation period. So back and forth we go, contrasting Antichrist's capital and God's capital. Okay? Contrasting the two. So note that point number 2. Somehow underline the two or something. Circle the two. All right, we'll begin with a statement of the destruction of Babylon. And this begins in verse 2 of chapter 50. Okay, we all there? All right. Verse 2. Declare and proclaim among the nations. Proclaim it and lift up a standard. Do not conceal it, but say, Babylon has been captured. Bel has been put to shame. Marduk has been shattered. Her images have been put to shame. Her idols have been shattered. So we begin with the failure of the gods of Babylon. We see that Babylonian idolatry is going to be worthless. And there'll be a lot of idolatry in the world before the Antichrist sets himself up to be God. He's the supreme idol. But there'll be a lot of idols in the world. And so there's a declaration in point A. And God wants this declaration to be extremely obvious. Don't conceal it. Set it up on a sign. Set up a standard. Put it up on a billboard. Publish it. Declare it. He says, I want the world, I don't want anyone to miss this. And neither should we. This is to be part of our worldview. What is the content of this declaration that's being put up on a billboard, on a standard? The content, five items. Last five items on the page. Babylon is taken. That means the city has fallen. Bel is put to shame. Bel, you see that as point A, is the storm god. Another title for Enlil. Enlil was the chief god of Nippur. Nippur is a city in central Babylonian. So we have this idol shame. Merodach is dismayed. Another name for Marduk, the chief god of Babylon and the head of the Babylonian pantheon. Points 3, A, B, and C. So all her images are put to shame. God is dealing with the failure of idolatry in Babylonian religion. Finally, point 5 there, we get a very earthy and graphic description of Babylonian idolatry. It's a Hebrew play on words. The word for idols sounds very much like the word for balls of excrement. So her idols are nothing but droppings on the ground. Okay? So Jeremiah, God is very, very graphic there. That's what he thinks of idolatry. All right. This destruction of Babylon will be accompanied by, guess what? An attack from the north in verse 3. Verse 3. For a nation has come up against her out of the north. It will make her land an object of horror, and there will be no inhabitant in it. Both man and beast have wandered off. They have gone away. So here's this first indication of this nation coming against her out of the north. Now, if this is not a reference to the Persians, let's see, why did I miss a time frame here for you? No, in verse 39, we were in the kingdom. Yeah, here we go. In chapters 50 and 51, we are in the tribulation period. I'm sorry I missed that time frame for you. Babylon's fall and Israel's deliverance takes place in the tribulation period. All right. Here's a map of modern Iran or ancient Persia, as it was known. And notice, Iran or Persia is east of Babylon. Cyrus was a Persian. Ancient Babylon was overrun by a man from the east. Now, the Medes are to the north, but Persia was the dominant power. So, this emphasis on the Medes leading the attack did not happen in Cyrus's day. So this did not happen in the past. Point B, when this attack comes, the land will be desolate. That didn't happen under Cyrus. In fact, Babylon was spared desolation. The results, point C, nobody dwelling there. People fleeing, people, man and beast gone. Point 4, never happened under Cyrus. Babylon remained quite populated for quite a while. So again, this pushes us off into the tribulation period. This was not fulfilled under Cyrus. Many commentators say it was. Just be aware of that. I do not agree with them at all on this. So there we are, the introduction to this, to the prophecy. Babylon is going to be destroyed by an attack from the north. Point B, guess what? Now we flip over to the other side of the coin. And at that time, Israel will be restored. Israel's final restoration will occur in connection with Babylon's final destruction. That's the reason we jump in verse 8 to the restoration of Israel. This is the first flip-flop back and forth that we will see in the next two long chapters. Israel's final restoration happens in conjunction with Babylon's final destruction. Okay, does that make sense? All right. So let's turn to first part of verse 4, chapter 50, verse 4. In those days and at that time, declares the Lord. What time? The destruction of Babylon. Okay, at the time of the final fall of Babylon, point 2, in the closing days of the tribulation, what's going to happen? Point B, second part of verse 4, Israel will be regenerated, saved, born again. Second part of verse 4. The sons of Israel will come, both they and the sons of Judah as well, the entire nation in other words, and they will go along weeping as they go, and it will be the Lord their God that they will seek. So you see point one there, it references Israel and Judah. In other words, the entire nation is going to be effective, and what's going to be happening? They're going to be seeking Jehovah their God. Is that true today? No. 80 to 90% of the Jewish people today are atheist or agnostic. We're not seeking the Lord our God. It will be only true at the end of the tribulation period when we become a regenerate nation. So the nation will be regenerated, born again at this time. Page 529. The Zionism of the nation is brought out in verse 5. They will ask for the way to Zion, turning their faces in its direction. And it will come that they will may join themselves to the Lord in an everlasting covenant that will not be forgotten. So notice point one. They're going to turn their faces towards Zion. They're going to be Zionists. So at this point, I want to take a little rabbit trail. We hear all about Zion and Zionism. What in the world is it? Okay? So let's start by asking the question, what is Zion? Well, here's a map of Jerusalem. Originally, Zion referred to the southeastern hill where the city of David was. This is Mount Zion. Okay? A piece of territory, a mountain. Then, as Israel occupied the area and as Jerusalem expanded, the definition later included the Temple Mount. Now, this is actually Mount Moriah here. This is Mount Zion. This is Mount Moriah. But the definition included both. So when you're speaking of Zion, you're speaking of both. Eventually, the definition expanded further to include all of Jerusalem. And then all of Judah was included in the thought. Sometimes the people, the Jewish people, are included in the thought Zion because we're Zionists, you know, that kind of thing. But predominantly, Zion is some territory. It's Judah and Jerusalem. That is Zion. Okay? Yes?
Wasn't there a reemergence of Zionism through somebody around 1880?
Yes, in the latter half of the 18th century, or in the 1800s, the modern Zionist movement began.
But there was someone who kind of coined it as something.
Yeah, right around Theodor Herzl's day, the term Zionism, I think, became popular. Yeah.
Someone made it something to strive for.
Yeah, Zionism is a common term today. So I want to define that term, okay? We now know what Zion is. What is Zionism? What is Zionism? Okay, well, a lot of opinions exist out there regarding Zionism. Let's ask the Palestinian Authority. This is the Palestinian Charter, section 22. Zionism is a political movement organically associated with international imperialism and antagonistic to all action for liberation and to progressive movements in the world. It is racist, fanatic in its nature, aggressive, expansionist and colonial in its aims and fascist in its methods. Eh? That's Mahmoud Abbas. That's the guy we got to make peace with. That's the Palestinian charter. All right, let's ask somebody else. Let's ask some Jewish Hasids. Not every Jewish person is in favor of Zionism. Okay? Go to this website, JewsNotZionist.org, I think it is, or it's JewsNotZionist.com. What'll you read if you go to that website? You'll read this. Zionists want a state in order to make Jews into heretics. The root of Zionism is heresy, and its branches can hardly be otherwise. So Zionism is a heresy. That's what some Jews feel. All right, let's ask somebody else. Let's ask the United Nations. Now, I went to the Jewish Virtual Library to get this, because if you go to the United Nations, you get this in a PDF, document. It's a pain in the neck to use. Okay, you can go to the UN and get it. But I just went to the Jewish Virtual Library. This is the United Nations General Assembly Resolution 3379, adopted November 10th, 1975, but repealed. The insanity was repealed in 1991. I won't bore you with all this. The General Assembly recalling blah, 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 and recalling also yada, 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 and taking note of blah, 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 and taking note also of yada, 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 and taking note also of yada, 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 determines. Okay, if you want to read through all that, that's fine. This is the bottom line. Determines that Zionism was a form of racism and racial discrimination. Okay, so the UN came to their senses after 20 years. Took them a while, but they did. Okay, let's ask somebody else. How about a Christian anti-Semite? I'm going to give Stan Rittenhouse the benefit of the doubt that he's a Christian, because he says he is. Okay, he wrote a book called For Fear of the Jews. I have this wonderful little tome in my anti-Semitic area of my library. I don't advise you to read it. It's pretty disgusting. But on page 7, this is what Stan Rittenhouse says. During this period, in between the first and second coming of Jesus Christ, a satanic counterfeit, political Zionism, masquerading as the state of Israel, will be established. So that's what Zionism is. It's a satanic counterfeit. All right, let's define it. Let's define it biblically. Okay, I'm going to give you a definition. Zionism describes an emotion. Zionism describes an emotion. Okay, here it is. Zionism is an expression of the longing and yearning that the Jewish people have had in the past and still have for our homeland. That's the proper definition of Zionism. Zionism is an expression of the longing and yearning that the Jewish people have had in the past and still have for our homeland. Question. Yeah, very similar. Yeah. Hatikva, the hope. Yeah. All right. Everybody get that? Writing fast? All you ladies are supposed to be trained in shorthand. In my day, that's what the ladies were taught. You know, that was the proper skills for home economics and shorthand, right? So ladies were taught. Question.
Is this your phraseology?
This my phraseology, yes.
What was Ben Gurion's phraseology?
I don't know. Can't give you that. Question.
And I've been really struggling with that ever since,
Yeah.
Do you know where she would be coming from?
Oh, sure. She'd be coming from the Palestinian declaration, or the Palestinian charter. Okay. Zionism is a political movement that's fascist and racist and everything else. See? So I hate Zionists. I don't hate Christians. I don't hate Jews. I just hate those Zionists, those fascists, racists. That's what they'd be saying. All right. Can I defend this from Scripture? Can I defend this definition from Scripture? Yes, I can. Psalm 137, verses 1 through 6. Does this sound like the definition I gave you? By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows, in the midst of it, we hung our harps, for there our captors demanded of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." Verse 4. How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, and what is Jerusalem here? It's a synonym for Zion. Parallel thought. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. That's Zionism, you guys. A lot of you in this room are Christian Zionists too. You'd like to live there. I know some of you would. And that's okay, you're grafted in. Question. Actually, it was coined by the Roman Caesar. Was it Hadrian? Yeah, Hadrian.
But he coined the term Palestine when they were the Philistines.
Yeah, it means land of the Philistines. Yeah, it doesn't even mean, it doesn't mean land of the Arabs. Yeah, it means land of the Philistines.
No significance, and that land isn't really their homeland. They were never a nation in the first place.
Exactly.
The
root of this goes back to Satan and his need to destroy the promises of God and the plan of God, because if God's program succeeds, Satan is toast. Okay? So that's why these lies come up. Okay. All right, that's Zionism. Let's get back then to page 529. Okay, so these Jewish people in the tribulation period will be Zionists. They will be born again, wanting to return to our homeland. Notice point 2b. They will enter into an everlasting covenant. What is an everlasting covenant that we have not entered into yet? The new covenant of Jeremiah 31:31. Jewish believers and Gentile believers enter individually into that covenant today, but the nation is not as a nation. And at the end of the tribulation, every living Jewish man, woman, and child will place their faith in Yeshua and enter into that covenant. We'll be a regenerated nation. Regenerated nation. All right. As they mourn for Zion and desire to return, our past condition is brought out in verse 6. Verse 6. My people have become lost sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray. They have made them turn aside in the mountains. They have gone along from mountain to hill and have forgotten their resting place. So the people are aptly described as lost sheep. That's a good description of Israel in the last 2,000 years and in the tribulation period. And why? Point A2 is very important. The leadership is at fault. The leadership has led the nation astray. And as a result, the picture is that of sheep wandering from mountain to hill, dispersed and confused. Points 3, 4, and 5. Not only have the people become dispersed, confused, and lost, they've also become attacked. In verse 7, all who come upon them have devoured them, and their adversaries have said, we are not guilty, inasmuch as they have sinned against the Lord, who is the inhabitation of righteousness, even the Lord, the hope of their fathers. So the people in which we have wandered, both for the last 2,000 years and in the tribulation period, devour us, persecute us. And guess what? Point 2, our adversaries claim innocence. See that? Point 3, point 2 there, point B, excuse me. Point 2, yes. We're not guilty of anything. Point A, they try to evade responsibility for their sin. Why? Well, those Jews, they deserve everything that they're getting. It's their fault. We're just carrying out judgment on them. They killed Christ. It's their fault. Now, I want you to notice, folks, Jewish unbelief, our unbelief, is not a justification for anti-Semitism. Anti-Semites like to make it so. They love to make it so. But our unbelief is not a justification for anti-Semitism. Okay? And the most common charge we get is that we're Christ killers. And I want to explore that charge just a little bit. I think I have enough time to do so. Let me read to you a revealing conversation Josh had in Israel last month with one of the guides there. Let me read this to you. I probably read it to you already, but it'll take on a little different impact at this time. Josh writes, "On the way home, a madracha named Ya'ara asked me why I came to Israel since I'm not Jewish. Ya'ara has only been in the IDF 1 month. She's 18 years old with blonde hair and blue eyes. She doesn't look like the other soldiers. I told her I'm a Christian that studies the Torah in Hebrew, keeps Jewish holidays, and even goes to synagogue sometimes. I told her that Jesus was Jewish, that the New Testament was written by Jewish men, and that I believe in the God of Israel, etc. She was shocked, to say the least. She told me that the only Christians she knows are the ones who call her Christ killer. Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, they're all over in Israel. All over. They all hold to this. She told me how she had never heard of a Christian like me and how happy she was to hear what I had to say. She said, never give up what you're doing. Okay? Christ killer. Okay, this is the question we have to ask. Who killed Christ? The theological term is deicide. Here's the question you have to ask. Is your Jewish neighbor, friend, coworker, relative solely, universally, and permanently to blame for the death of Jesus? This is what the anti-Semites claim. The Jews are solely responsible. They're the ones at fault. They're universally responsible, every single one of them, from the first century down to today, because they are permanently to blame. Every single one of them are Christ killers. That's the anti-Semites' view. All right, let's examine this a little bit. I have a little booklet I made, Who Killed Christ? Who Killed Jesus? Yeshua. This, you should have this and read it and be familiar with it if you talk to your Jewish friend, because this is going to come up. You better believe it, and you better have an answer. And here's the answer. The seven responsible parties for the death of Yeshua. One, God himself. Acts 2:23 and 4:27 say Yeshua died according to the plan of God. God the Father bears responsibility. It's his plan. Number two, Satan. In Genesis 3:15, we learn that the Messiah will crush Satan. In Revelation 12:4, we learn that he, as a dragon, wanted to devour the child, the Messiah, when he was born. Satan wanted Jesus as dead as he could. Thirdly, the world. John 7:7 and 15:18 says the world hates Yeshua. The world hates me, he says. Fourthly, the Romans, representing the Gentile world in Acts 2:23 and 4:27. The Romans put him on the cross. Of course, we in the Jewish community like to focus on that one. The Romans' fault. Number four, guess what? The Jewish people, Acts 2:23 and 4:27, don't evade Jewish responsibility. That's not the truth. There is Jewish responsibility, but not the way the anti-Semites make it. Sixthly, Jesus is responsible for his crucifixion. Why? In John 10, 1-18, he said, nobody takes my life from me. I lay it down. Okay, he stepped into the cross. He knew what he was getting into. And finally, do you know who the last responsible person is? You. Romans 5:8. Jesus died for each one here. We're responsible. Remember, there is some responsibility placed on the Jewish people in the scriptures. 1/7 of the responsibility. Don't evade it. But don't blow out of proportion the way the anti-Semites do either. And again, if you want a detailed look at all this, pick up one of these booklets. Okay, everybody got that? I see some pens flying. Time is flying too. And I need to get one more page in. We'll make it. I won't keep you too late. All right, everybody ready? All right, page 530. There is a call in verse 8 for the Jewish community in Babylon to flee prior to her destruction. Verse 8. Here's the warning to God's people. Now, we will heed this warning. Wander away from the midst of Babylon. Go forth from the land of the Chaldeans. Be also like male goats at the head of the flock. So here's that warning. Get out. This did not happen when Cyrus destroyed Babylon. We lived in Babylon for hundreds of years after. During the tribulation period, we will obey. We'll leave the he-goats, we're the leaders of the flock. You can see in point C, though. See there. This is also stated in Isaiah 48:20. This warning. Go forth from Babylon. Flee from the Chaldeans. Declare with the sound of joyful shouting. Proclaim this. Send it out to the ends of the earth. Say, the Lord has redeemed His servant Jacob. Again, with the destruction of the Chaldeans, and Babylon will become the will come the restoration of Israel. That's the point there. And also, Revelation 18, 4 and 5, the warning goes out again. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive of her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. This is a reference to God's people, my people. The church is gone. We've been raptured long before this. Any believers and Jewish people, get out of Babylon. Of course, if you're a believer, you probably won't be there anyway because you'll be have your head cut off. So these are the Jewish, the remnant, just before their salvation. Okay, then comes the destruction of Babylon in verse 9. For behold, I am going to arouse and bring up against Babylon a horde of great nations from the land of the north, and they will draw up their battle lines against her. From there she will be taken captive. Their arrows will be like an expert warrior who does not return empty-handed. So now we see that from the north is going to come a huge coalition army. Point B there. The emphasis is now on the coalition that's led by the Medes. And it comes from the north. And we learn this also in Isaiah 17:20. Behold, I'm going to stir up who? The Medes. They're called the Medes because that's the location of... the Medes lived in that location during Jeremiah's day. I'm going to stir up the Medes against them, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold, but their bows will mow down the young men. They will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will they will their eye pity children. And Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Hasn't happened yet, has it? It will never be inhabited. It is inhabited today. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will the shepherds make their flocks lie down there, etc., etc., etc. So here it is. This is the third stage of the campaign of Armageddon, the destruction of Babylon. Out of the north comes this coalition of armies against the Antichrist, in rebellion to the Antichrist, and after he leaves and joins his troops, Babylon is destroyed. Babylon is destroyed. And that's the point of verse 10, which we'll close with verse 10 tonight. Chaldea will become plunder. All who plunder her will have enough, declares the Lord. And so the picture here is of a lamb ravaged by a lion. Just totally destroyed. Hasn't happened yet. Keep that in mind. Hasn't happened yet. No matter what other commentators say. Hasn't happened yet. All righty. We'll pick it up next week on page 531. So let me go ahead and close. Ooh, I've kept you 2.5 minutes over. So I better let you get out of here.